This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The View from 22 podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. In this episode, we'll be discussing our cover story, ISIS in Crisis, by the BBC's Paul Wood. He says that behind the propaganda, the caliphate is in disarray. Sources inside ISIS say morale has plummeted after a series of defeats. They may be attracting recruits, but many fighters are disillusioned and thousands have already defected. I'll be joined by Paul himself and Dr. Alia Brahimi, Director of Contest Global, to ask just how deep the crisis runs and whether ISIS can recover. Next, a very different kind of crisis. Jeremy Corbyn had said he wanted open discussion in his shadow cabinet. But in this week's reshuffle, he sacked two shadow ministers who had publicly criticised him. So was this the week the moderates were frozen out? Our political editor James Forsyth and our editor Fraser Nelson will be joining me to discuss where this leaves the Labour leader and his party. And finally, should Cecil Rhodes fall? In this week's magazine, our art critic Martin Gayford examines the history of removing statues from the ancient Egyptians to the present day. Most recently, the Rhodes Must Fall student campaign has targeted statues of Cecil Rhodes in Cape Town and in Oxford. They say having a statue of Rhodes glorifies a colonialist murderer. And with me to debate this are Harry Mount, who says the campaigners are pampered students, and Dawn Foster of The Guardian, who says they're doing what students are meant to do, engaging with difficult historical truths. On to our first topic, ISIS in crisis. I'm joined by Paul Wood, who is down the line, and Dr. Alia Brahimi. Paul Wood, in your cover piece this week, you talk about low morale within the group. Is this the beginning of the end for ISIS?
It's certainly the end of the beginning, but nobody should think that the end of ISIS is going to be quick or easy. There are a large number of diehard fanatics who believe literally in prophecy and scripture, which says that they are about to fight the final battle marking end times in Syria against the West and its allies. These are not people who are going to give up easily. Now, if you look at the map, they've certainly lost more territory than they've gained. But as they get squeezed down into the last territory that they hold, especially in places like Mosul, these are areas where they can count on support from the population, and it will be extremely difficult street fighting for instance, the Iraqi army to go into Mosul. And even when Sunni Arabs, tribal leaders, abandon ISIS, you still have the hardliners who will fight to the finish.
Alia Brahimi, what do you think of that?
I think Paul's right, and in his article he very well captures the fact that for the first time in 18 months, ISIS appears exposed and fragile, and certainly on the defensive. And I think that's due to these extraordinary military setbacks in Iraq, in Tikrit, Sinjar, Baiji, Ramadi, and Mosul next. And then the Kurds are on the march in Syria, and ISIS faces the prospect of a war on two fronts, in Aleppo and Raqqa. But crucially, there's also been signs of political awakening and movement, with Abadi's attempts in Iraq to turn the page on the anti-Sunni discrimination, and also hope now for peace in Syria, however fragile that is. So because I think the military setbacks for ISIS are actually a secondary to the progress that's been made on the political level. And we also seem to have sort of division and fragmentation within ISIS coming to the fore, which has been bubbling, for months now. And that's related to the fact that it's a state-building project, right? So to control people and a population who don't agree with you, you have to be spectacularly brutal. And that is divisive. And also the fact that they have access to taxation, extortion, extraction, all these localized resources, that creates competition. So it's looking much bleaker than it has been, but the leadership also knows that there's an enormous amount of political work that has to be done to consolidate these military gains. And so when Paul in his article talks about fighters in Ramadi melting away, you know, we have to assume that they believe that they will be able to come back and fight another day.
This is ultimately a political problem and not a military problem. And most Sunnis still feel alienated from the government in Baghdad. I was in a town called Bakuba, where the local mayor, who was a Sunni, showed me photographs of 49 bodies, all of whom had been shot in the back of the head, all of whom had been delivered to him from the local police station run by a mixture of Shiite militias and policemen loyal to Baghdad, all Shia. Now, the new government in Baghdad is going some way to address the feeling that Sunnis have that Baghdad does not represent them. But Sunnis are still extremely fearful of the security forces because the security forces still rely on Shiite militias to do some of the hard fighting. And that's going to be the problem in turning around Mosul. A lot of Sunnis are quite happy with rule by ISIS, or certainly are prepared to have ISIS as what they believe will be a better alternative to the threat of rape, pillage and murder by Shiite militias sent by Baghdad.
Ali Abrahimi, what do you make of that?
I think that's absolutely right. I think ISIS is a symptom of the deep political crises in Iraq and Syria more than it is a cause. And this has been going on since 2003. And until that political crisis, until these crises are resolved, this phenomenon will just continue to transmute, regroup and return, no matter how many foreign fighters desert it. Because it's fundamentally a local answer to a local question, which is who will protect the Sunni of Syria and Iraq in the post-2003 political order. So it's worth reflecting that its predecessor groups, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Islamic State in Iraq, the Mujahideen Shura Council, they were also once pronounced dead. But the political conditions didn't change, so they've reemerged. And we also have to look at the broader picture and pan out a bit and recognize at the very least that ISIS is gaining ground in other parts of the world. Not the most alarming of which, of course, is Libya.
Paul Wood, you have said there will always be a demand for these kinds of terror groups. Is there any way of reducing that demand?
Well, you have the Syrian and Iraqi context. I think the Syrian civil war is going to last 10 or 15 years, and people may stay there. There are, as I say in the piece, there is a competition among these different groups for recruits, and people change sides and they change to Nusra and they change to ISIS and then they go back again. So that will happen within the Syrian and the Iraqi context. But there is a conversation that Western countries and Western governments have to have with their own Muslim population. And this is really a theological discussion and one of which non-Muslims like myself are ill-qualified to comment on.
And Ali Abrahimi, what sort of conversations do you think should be taking place?
In the West, I think that one of our key tasks, of course, is to challenge the ideology. And that's something that's put front and centre by the government currently. But I think that generally this phenomenon is a local phenomenon and the foreign fighter element is just the sort of the tip. And I think that what's happening on the ground, the violence is being driven by grievances and by the political context that Paul has described. And until we deal with those grievances, as Paul indicated, ISIS will come back in different forms. So I think that the key is to actually look at stabilizing the region and look at dealing with the enablers of terrorism, the fighters, the operating spaces, the money, but also the drivers, which are grievances against the governments in Baghdad and Damascus. And the issue that raises, it's a very important issue, is whether they can be our partners in this fight against terrorism, or whether in working with them, we're ultimately strengthening the drivers of the terrorist threat.
Another organisation in crisis is the Labour Party. This week, Jeremy Corbyn finally conducted his lengthy and limited revenge reshuffle. James Forsyth has written about it in his politics column in this week's Spectator. I'm joined by James and by our editor, Fraser Nelson. James, what have you made of this reshuffle? Who comes out the most powerful from it?
Jeremy Corbyn, I think. I mean, you can laugh at the process of this, how long it took to make relatively small changes. But he's actually succeeded in doing quite a lot of things he wanted to. He's now got a fellow unilateralist in as Shadow Defence Secretary. He has shown that Tom Watson's power is limited in that one of Tom Watson's best friends, Michael Duggar, has been sacked. And he's also revealed how spineless the Shadow Cabinet are. You know, after Michael Duggar was sacked, having appointed himself as a kind of Shadow Cabinet shop steward, taking a pop at the leader's office when he felt that they were doing things that were inimical to the Shadow Cabinet's interests, nine members of the Shadow Cabinet, I think, tweeted out in support of Michael Duggar, but none of them walked out. It just showed how cowed they are by Jeremy Corbyn and the fact that the Labour Party membership and electorate continue to support him.
Fraser, don't you think that the Shadow Cabinet should be cowed by Jeremy Corbyn, given he's the leader, given he should be able to choose who to sack and who to hire?
Yes, I do. I think every reshuffle is a test of leader's authority. That's the whole purpose. And Jeremy Corbyn's got every right to say that he wants his front bench to speak his agenda with one voice. He doesn't want to have a a situation where he's calling for example, calling against strikes in Syria, and his shadow foreign secretary is saying, no, I disagree with you, there should be strikes in Syria. I mean, this is not how proper opposition is supposed to be organised. Of course, Labour is pretty far away from being a proper opposition, but Corbyn's perfectly entitled to try to make it a little bit more like the party he wants it to become. But that said, I don't think he achieved very much. This was, as David Cameron said, one of the slowest reshuffles in history. And when you look at it, there is there's Hilary Benn still there in his job, who was the most conspicuous example of defying the leader's will. I mean, as you know, Paul Sinclair used to work for Gordon Brown, made quite a good point after the reshuffle. He was saying, what's the point in having a Stalinist run the Labour Party if he can't even organise a proper purge?
I mean, though, the thing is that, yes, he hasn't got total control over the Labour Party, but when you consider how few MPs voted for him, it is remarkable how secure his position is. And this was a mistake made by people like Michael Duggar and Pat McFadden, was that they joined the shadow cabinets to the shadow cabinet at the beginning of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and lent it legitimacy. There was this idea that the shadow cabinet was going to reflect the full spectrum of Labour opinion. What Jeremy Corbyn is making clear is that every time his position gets a bit stronger, he'll discard a few more of those who disagree with him until, by 2020, he will have a shadow cabinet in his own image. And it is quite clear that he left Hilary Benn in place because the Syria vote is now behind them. It's highly unlikely we're going to have another vote in the House of Commons of that nature. The next big fight coming up is Trident, and he's now in a much stronger position to win that fight, because the Shadow Defence Secretary, the person and the people who will be leading the Labour Party's defence review, agree with him on Trident, and the Labour membership agrees with him on Trident. So what are the Shadow Cabinet members who support the nuclear deterrent going to do? Are they going to resign because Labour Party policy has been changed by the democratically expressed will of the Labour membership? He keeps boxing his opponents in and giving them bad territory to fight on. And this is an odd thing to say because it goes so against what the conventional wisdom was just a few months ago, but it is looking to me more and more likely that Jeremy Corbyn makes it all the way to 2020.
Do you agree with that, Fraser?
Yes, I do very much. I mean, it comes back to what James was saying about the tweets. That's the worst they can do. I mean, they know that if they were to try to move against him, then what would happen? Any leadership contest with the Labour Party membership being transformed, as it was, by the events of last summer, mean that Corbyn would win, or if it wasn't Corbyn, then somebody very much like him. So, in a way, I sometimes wonder if Corbyn is trying to actually antagonise his party to prompt them into an early leadership putsch, which would fail and leave him where he is. But I think that even the Labour Party critics, they knew the mechanics of it. This party has never got rid of a bad leader in its post-war history. They're not very good at doing it. The Tories can do it over a wet weekend. Even the Lib Dems were getting quite good at it, but Labour are useless. And I think that Jeremy Corbyn reducing his critics to this sort of pitiful digital moaning demonstrates that they can't do much against him, because if they could, they probably would.
So do you think that they should have walked out of the shadow cabinet, those members who are still in there, who still support Trident renewal, but know in their hearts that Jeremy Corbyn is going to change the party's policy on that? Do you think they should just up sticks and run now?
Well, when he became leader, the Labour front benches were divided. Do you stay in, do you serve in his team and try to shape it from the inside, fight the battle for moderation from inside, or do you just say, I want no part of this? I think those who decided to stay out from the beginning have been vindicated by the path that Jeremy Corbyn has taken. He doesn't really care that much about opposition. What he wants to do is to reshape the Labour Party. I mean, next, you're going to find that Labour's National Policy Forum is going to be disbanded. It's going to be run by the National Executive Committee, which is all stuffed by Corbyn people. His primary aim is to reconstruct the Labour Party in a way that will put his particular faction in charge. He doesn't really care too much about PMQs. Once his guys have got control of the Labour Party, the real mission is accomplished.
So, James, at the end of your column, you suggest that there's talk of a new party coming out of the Labour Party. Do you think that's going to happen before 2020, or do you think that those who might split off are going to languish for a few years longer?
I suspect that what will happen is that the people will wait for the 2020 election in the hope that a big, heavy defeat would bring the Labour Party to its senses. I don't think there's any indications at the moment that that's what will happen. I think the obstacle to the new party is that there is about 20 to 25% of the country that will vote for Labour. And starting off without any of that kind of tribal vote is very hard. The SDP demonstrated that. And the last election, UKIP got more than 12% of the national vote and one MP. It's got no easier to break the mould of British politics in the last 20 years, whatever some people might say. I suspect But if after 2020 Labour are beaten and either Jeremy Corbyn or another very left-wing figure stays in place as leader, I suspect at that moment the moderates will up sticks and go and form a new party. I think one of the interesting things is that this EU In campaign has brought together the Blairites and the Orange Book Lib Dems, and they are finding that they basically agree on everything. And that I wonder whether out of that, you know, they joke at the moment, you know, after a few drinks, oh, we'll have to go and set up our own new party. But lots of things in life start off as jokes before becoming serious.
Fraser, as James says, it's very difficult to set up a new party. Mm. Does that not mean that the left is doomed for the next decade at least?
I wouldn't say doomed. I think if the last 12 months taught us anything, is to be very careful when making predictions about British politics. We're living in thrillingly unpredictable times. I'm not so sure that they would split, because if you look at who the moderates hero worship, it's people like Blair and John Reid. The Blairites were the people who stayed in Labour in 1983 when everything was going dark. They didn't leave the party. They stayed and they fought and they won. And I think that's the lesson that the Labour moderates will draw. Right now, the temptation will be very strong. But, I mean, I agree with James that I wouldn't put any money on Corbyn leaving in the next 2 years. He's probably more likely to last in the election than not. But that said, anything could happen. There could be an economic collapse. The Euro referendum could turn politics upside down. There are so many variables between now and then that if I were a moderate Labour Party MP, I would not jump ship.
I mean, the other great worry for the Labour Party is this split in their ranks that is becoming more and more apparent in this reshuffle. You know, we saw, I mean, I live in Islington, I don't say this against Islington, but it's very telling to me, to my mind, how London-centric, how Islington-centric the leader's team are, and now the shadow cabinet is becoming. In this reshuffle, you saw Michael Duggar, you know, Yorkshire Labour, working class, classic old Labour right figure, removed. Emily Formbury, classic metropolitan liberal, coming in to be shadow defence secretary. This cleavage between kind of metropolitan liberals and Labour's traditional working class base is getting worse and worse and worse. And all, you know, if UKIP could get its act together, it could massively predate on that Labour vote up north.
How, Fraser, can those Labour MPs who you think should stay in the party and fight, how can they realistically do that? I mean, they could put on 100,000 extra supporters on the membership, but they don't seem to be very good at doing that, because I was briefed they were going to do that for the Liz Kendall campaign, and they didn't really manage to come anywhere close to that with their 4.5% of the vote. So at what point do those MPs realise that they're just not getting anywhere at all?
Well, their mission, I think, is to try to make the case for to basically have a caucus, a moderate caucus, which is coming out with more than tweets, coming out with proper ideas, coming out with a coherent policy agenda. They can start to build within the Labour Party and make sure that there is that dimension to the party, but it remains a broad church. I mean, Corbyn can't kick them all out of Parliament. He might want to try to deselect a few. But when it comes to actually dethroning Corbyn, that is procedurally very difficult for them, but there is still the possibility, albeit quite a slim one, that Corbyn does stand down, and then of course it's the MPs who decide who goes down to the final list. Everybody needs, what, 35 votes? It could well be that one of the far left members of Corbyn and his friends, but none of them actually make it to the leadership ticket next time around. So, you know, there are glimmers of light, just not very many of them.
A reminder of our special subscription offer for listeners of The View from 22. For just £22, you can receive a 22-week subscription to The Spectator in the post, along with access to our website, iPad, iPhone and Android apps. Sign up to read all the articles discussed in this podcast at spectator.co.uk/22. On to our third topic, toppling the Cecil Rhodes statue. I'm joined by Harry Mount and Dawn Foster. Harry, what do you make of the argument that those behind the Rhodes Must Fall campaign are making, which is that a statue of Rhodes glorifies a colonialist murderer?
That argument in and of itself is probably true. I think the big question is whether you think as a result of that you should tear it down. And I think very strongly you shouldn't, on the basic principle that beautiful and interesting architecture is often built by or paid for not very nice people, particularly in Oxford. I was at Oxford, used to work in the Codrington Library there in All Souls, which was built by Christopher Codrington, who'd made his fortune out of slavery in the late 17th century. horrible, undeniably disgusting thing, but it would be ludicrous to tear down that statue of Codrington in the library and this whole extraordinary library. You can go right across Oxford, Christchurch, built by Cardinal Wolsey, not a particularly appetising figure. Just across the road from here, the Henry VII Chapel at Westminster Abbey, built by Henry VIII, a brutal murderer. And so I think the principle is it's completely fair enough to be offended by Cecil Rhodes. That's completely acceptable. He wasn't really a very nice man. The question is whether you then jump from whether you're offended to whether you should tear down your beautiful, stroke historically interesting surroundings. And I would say definitely not.
Dawn Foster, what do you make of that?
I can understand completely why the students want to remove it. I don't think anybody's actually argued that they should get rid of the library or the architecture around it. I think they want to remove the statue and for that to be a symbol. So in as much as having a statue there, you know, commemorating Rhodes, it seems a symbol of colonialism, removing it and having a gap there, a gap that's quite visible, is equally quite symbolic of the fact that we are reevaluating history and reevaluating what it means. And I think that either defacing statues or removing them can actually be very, very deeply symbolic. So I was in Bow recently and I saw the statue of Gladstone. And when it was first unveiled, the match girls in Bow found out that they'd had a shilling docked from their wages. And as a result, a few of them poured their own blood on Gladstone to show how much they were suffering. And even today, if you walk past, every few weeks somebody will daub red paint on Gladstone's hands to commemorate the suffering of those women. So, and you see it across the globe as well. I remember when I was younger, I remember very little about the Iraq War because I was a teenager, but I do remember the first night of airstrikes and when Saddam's statue toppled and exactly how much media attention was paid to it and also how moving a lot of Iraqi people found it.
But where do you draw the line? The point that Harry makes is that there are a number of buildings and statues that commemorate people who haven't done particularly pleasant things. A lot of Bristol, for instance, is built with slave trade money. So how far do you go?
I think how far you go depends how strongly you feel. So I think part of the reason why Rhodes has become such a focal point is because he's still in the middle of universities where racism is still a problem. So in South Africa, the legacy of apartheid, and you know Cecil Rhodes had a big part in that, is still very prevalent. And a lot of students in Oxford are unbelievably oppressed by racism still. I think Oriel College, if I remember correctly, has two black students, and that's it. I mean, you can go as far as you want. A lot of people were opposed to Mahatma Gandhi's statue because of some of his dubious ideas about race. But you can either remove it or you can have a discussion about it. I mean, personally, I'd rather see like an Ambedkar statue next to Gandhi's rather than taking it away. But I think it's for the people who are affected by the legacy to decide.
And isn't that the problem, Harry Mount, that actually those who are resisting this at the top of institutions are often people from white backgrounds who haven't been affected by the slave trade in a negative way?
Yes, that's true. But sorry to repeat the point. I can completely see why people would be offended by a statue of Cecil Rhodes. The big jump is to whether you then remove a statue. And I do think something's changed. When I was at Oxford 20 years ago, if I'd been offended by a statue, which I wasn't, but if I had been, I wouldn't have thought it was then my right to tear it down. I actually, when I was at university, I went to Russia and China and saw the living, the dead bodies of Mao and Lenin. And I think they were both evil men with evil ideologies, but I wouldn't have thought for a moment that they should be taken away. And in fact, despite taking against their ideologies, it was extremely interesting to see their bodies. So I don't think there's anything wrong with having a statue of a long-dead person. Cecil Rhodes died in 1902, I think. It becomes historically interesting. I don't think a statue of somebody dead for so long in and of itself can be offensive. Whereas I can see there is a difference in Martin Gayford's very enjoyable article in this week's Spectator. It's mostly about toppling either living figures like the statue of Assad in Syria or recently dead figures like Saddam in Iraq, that famous toppling of the statue in Baghdad. And I can completely see if you're incensed with the leader who's just been oppressing you for all of your life, you tear down that image of a living person. I do think it's different when it jumps into history. And so I don't know how far you draw the line. There is this actual statue of Christopher Codrington, the slaver, in All Souls. No one's suggesting that should be torn down. Perhaps that's the next logical move. But I do think someone who's been dead for a long time, that statue of them, or in the case of Mao or Lenin, in and of itself becomes historically interesting rather than offensive. And if you find it offensive, I accept that. But I don't think it's your right to use your offence to be assuaged by it being removed.
Dawn Foster, why do students who are offended have a right, or think they have a right, to destroy what Harry argues are historical artefacts?
I think honestly, I've spoken to some of the students involved, and I think honestly, some of them would like to see it taken down and destroyed. Some of them would like to see it removed and put somewhere else. Other people...
Where do they want it?
Some people say it could happily be in a museum nearby in Oxford with more context about his role in Zimbabwe and South Africa and how the Glen Grey Act was a foundational stone of apartheid. But actually, I think a lot of people are just using it as a way to force open debate about Rhodes' legacy and about the fact that Rhodes wasn't simply an old man who had you know, carried out a lot of crimes. He is a symbol of just how much money can be used to try and whitewash history and try and whitewash people's crimes. I mean, most people I've spoken to who are quite young haven't heard of Cecil Rhodes, but they've heard of Rhodes scholarships when they go into university. And for a lot of people in Oxford, that's still a sticking point.
Do you think those scholarships should be abolished?
I think they should be replaced. I think perhaps they could be renamed. I think the university should put more money into widening diversity and making access easier. You know, Oxford is an excellent university, but in terms of diversity, it's still falling massively behind many, many, many other universities. So,
and would removing a statue instigate that? Would it symbolise that in some way?
I think for the students involved, it might show that the university had some commitment to taking their concerns about racism seriously. And I think Oriel acted very swiftly, in comparison to South Africa, and removed the plaque and said they would open up a debate about that. So from February, there'll be a consultation period with academic students and the local community to see exactly what they do. I mean, honestly, I don't think it's going to happen because it's a heritage, it's a heritage site. I think a lot of students understand that, and they're actually using this as a way to open the debate about racism in a way that simply saying Oxford is racist wouldn't. If you say I want to tear down a statue, you suddenly get people talking.
Harry Mount, what do you make of that?
I think it's certainly true. More people have heard of Cecil Rhodes in the last month than they've probably heard of in the previous century, and that's a good thing. When I was at Oxford, despite being very interested in architecture and statues, I must say, I probably walked past it 1,000 times, I never actually saw it. So it's, it has thrown a great amount of focus onto him. And I agree with Dawn, it's extremely unfair that so few people of racial minorities go to Oxford, but I'd have thought it would be much more effective to have even one extra person from a racial minority going to Oxford than to tear down a statue of a long dead person. I do think there has been a massive increase in sensitivity of undergraduates. Other things like no platforming, trigger issues and safe spaces. They're all symptoms of the same thing, which is a suppression of free speech or free expression because of a fear of being offended or because of actually being offended. And I think one of the things of growing up, particularly going to university, is to be prepared to accept people disagreeing with you or even offending you without, by all means, get very angry, but without, as it were, either hitting them or, much lower down, obviously, on the scale of things, trying to change the physical nature of an extremely beautiful city.
So finally, Dawn Foster, are today's students too easily offended?
I think there's a spectrum. I think that when I was at university 5 years ago, a lot of people were starting to talk about no platforming in terms of fascists, and I worry a little bit when it's extended to people who don't present an immediate threat in terms of violent fascism. But I think a lot of students are actually just becoming a bit more vocal about the way in which they want to debate things. So some students want to debate traditionally, but they also recognise that there are certain other factors like gender, class, race, etc., that mean that you may feel less comfortable. So I think it can go too far. But at the same time, I think it's also good that students are thinking in interesting ways about how they want to debate.
And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you to all of our guests for joining, and thank you for listening.
Gary, Winston Wolf, Direct Line. The landlord Mike says you wrecked his place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with Direct Line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria and excess apply, underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.